when we're speaking about the paramis, we're really speaking about two things in a way that maybe are the same, but certainly one aspect they are describing the fabric of compassion, and the other aspect is that they really are describing the landscape as of a liberated heart-mind. They are both practices, and when they're brought to fruition, they are called the perfections. So before we move on, did anybody have any questions following on the Sila discussion? Yeah. The question is about using metta to protect from obsession. I think this is one of the most underestimated aspects of metta practice, in that it does protect the mind from the grip of obsessive thinking. For a very simple reason, because we don't entertain two thoughts at the same time. So obsessive thinking is fueled by, well, a certain degree of a feeling of helplessness often. But clearly there is a real grip in obsessive thinking of a groove in the mind. It's not only a groove in the mind, it's actually often a neural pathway. You know, so by consciously using metta in the form of the phrases, we're bringing into that more unconscious, helpless place an intentional use of thought with the phrases. So it's not that it cures obsession, but it can, you know, a big part of mindfulness practice is learning to be mindful of the mind and learning to use thought wisely. So metta practice in the midst of obsessive thinking can bring enough of a kind of pause to take the fire out of the obsession, that it then, the obsession or the roots of the obsession can be approached in a more conscious way. I mean, it is, you know, and I'll go into this later, but it is one of the aspects of, you know, being aware of what we're choosing to participate in, and indeed that at times there may be choices. Mm-hmm. Okay, so when we talk about these paramis, they're not necessarily linear in the way that I'm talking about them. This is a kind of general way that they are presented in this order. I think there is a certain kind of linear sense to it in the roots in generosity and sila. Dana and sila, I would say, are like the core roots. But as we move on now into some of the other paramis, I wouldn't necessarily want to consider them in a linear developmental sense in the way that I would probably consider dana and sila as being kind of primary cultivations that allows many of the other paramis to develop and to be cultivated. So the third of the paramis in this list is renunciation. Excuse me. Again, not the most frequently used word in our culture. I should probably not use much at all. Now, I think because of our kind of, because it's a word that's not naturalized to us, I think it's a word that many people have some curious associations with when they hear that word, you know, as something belonging to perhaps a monastic order. It may be a word that even has kind of connotations of a kind of disconnection or coldness or passionless, lifeless kind of existence. An emotional bleakness is often associated with the word renunciation. But I think it's actually pretty hard to get away from the reality that this teaching is actually a renunciate tradition. And bearing in mind that, you know, sometimes I've heard people say, well, that's a sort of, you know, renunciation is something very middle class kind of teaching. But bearing in mind, the Buddha was teaching renunciation in a time in India that was probably frequented for most people by pretty direly difficult, challenging lives, where people had very, very little, I'm quite sure. And he emphasized the teaching of renunciation. Now, it is important to remember that in this path, renunciation is really framed in a very, very specific way as being one of the greatest gifts of happiness and contentment that we could offer to ourselves. So it is not taught as, you know, being without, doing without, disconnecting, being deprived. It is taught as a particular quality of heart and mind that is a gift of contentment and happiness. But it's also seen as a gift of freedom, because it's a way of aligning ourselves with wise view, with the reality that actually, you know, we can't hold on to anything, that we can't grasp the ungraspable, that we don't have the power to control the world of conditions, you know, and that nothing truly can be owned or possessed or claimed as mine, as belonging to me. So in a way, renunciation is a very direct teaching to align ourselves with the essence of wise view, which is actually said to be the gift of happiness. In this sense, renunciation, not holding, not clinging, not contracting, is taught as being a way of stepping out of the world of conflict and argument. Most of the difficulty that we experience in our own minds, that we experience probably in many of our relationships, is the argument that things are simply not the way that we want them to be. Kind of boils down to that, doesn't it? Things are not the way we want them to be. So we can live in this kind of chronic state of argument with the way things are, because they're not the way they want them to be. And therefore, we find ourselves in a tremendous state of turmoil and torment. And his teaching does get quite simple in some way. Now, in the early days of the Buddha, and bearing in mind, you know, the challenge of what it must have been in those early days when men and women went to join the Buddha in the homeless life. When they went to become monks and nuns. In the tradition of India at that time, you know, people who did that were dead to their families. They would even have funeral rites for them. But to go from a life where probably most people who joined the Buddha as monks and nuns were probably people who already had very little, and going into a life where there was absolutely nothing to rely upon. There would be absolutely nothing to rely upon. This was, I think, probably a remarkable act of courage in that time. What were the first teachings they were given? The first teachings they were given were actually the teachings of the four great contentments, where the Buddha would say upon becoming a monk or nun, be content with whatever food you are given, or even if you're given no food at all. Be content with whatever lodging you are given, or even if you have no lodging at all. Be content with whatever clothing, whatever robes you are given, or even if you are given none at all. And the four, and medicine. And the fourth, and then he would say, and delight. Delight in the cultivation of the wholesome and the skillful, and the falling away of the unwholesome and the unskillful. And he described these four great contentments as really being the foundation of a noble life. Now, centuries ago, even within this, the Buddha did point out that leaving one's home in the world did not a renunciate make. And any monk or nun would, I think, willingly and happily tell you today that there can be plenty of clinging and craving and aversion that can go on beneath the simplicity of the robes, that to change one's geography and one's clothing is not a guarantee of changing one's mind. And even when the Buddha would speak about these four great contentments, he would all, knowing the ingenuity of the human mind, he would always be cautioning against conceit, including poverty conceit. You know, that is saying, you know, that just because you've got, you know, a robe that's all shabby and filled with holes, that does not make you a better nun than Sally down the road who's got a silk one. Knowing that even in that environment, the mind still goes turns on. Now, these contentments were primarily a teaching of not tying our happiness and freedom to the world of conditions. Not agreeing to the world of conditions being the gatekeepers of happiness. Not agreeing to living in a state of lack and want, and how much we can do this, you know, that I would be happy if, fill in the blanks, you know, I would be peaceful if, you know, I had the better car, a different body, different meditation experience, if this difficult person in my life would go away. It is a way, when conditions hold the keys to our freedom, there is no refuge inwardly. There is no refuge inwardly. Now, renunciation is primarily, well, there's many reasons why renunciation was taught. But it was so much to challenge the energy of craving. So much to challenge the, it was the antidote to the energy of craving. To challenge the whole momentum of becoming that can so govern our lives. The speaker on, by the way. It's not on. I didn't think it was on. This is not on. I wonder why I'm shouting. I can stop shouting now. So, what does renunciation essentially challenge? Enchantment. Cultivates enchantment. Living under the spell. You know, it's like all our fairy tales, you know, living under the spell that externalizes the source of happiness and peace and joy into objects, things, possessions, attainments. Living under that spell of enchantment that keeps us running around and keeps us often so agitated. So renunciation is actually, again, it's an investigation. but it is a cultivation of disenchantment. Coming, waking up from the spell, not a rejection of the world, not a rejection of things or people, not a rejection of all the loveliness that surrounds us, but disenchantment, waking up from the spell that somehow that the source of happiness, the source of peace, the source of joy lies in things. It's a kind of projected promise that can govern our lives, and as we can see, that makes us so agitated. You know, I got this, not happy for a moment, now I need this, now I need to rearrange this, now I need to get this. The agitation of always being on the prowl. Now, there is something, you know, that this, there's so many ways in which this teaching needs to come out of the abstract, out of the theoretical, and into the felt experience. Because I think it is so important that we actually do feel the painfulness of what it means to live in a state of perpetual hunger. The hunger of the heart, the hunger of the enchantment. How painful that is, and how it is an ongoing source of inner abandonment and the source of so much pain. Renunciation is not born of aversion. It's never born of aversion, but this is the shadow side of renunciation. You know, I don't want to deal with this, I just walk away. You know, and call it letting go. That's the shadow side. But I don't think that genuine renunciation is born of aversion, but the sincere wish to know an inner freedom that is no longer bound to conditions. It comes down to that. Now, for many of us, our first introduction to renunciation is probably in the form of involuntary renunciation. And this is part of all of our lives when people we love die or we're separated from them. When we lose something we cherish and value, when we are somehow disappointed in our wishes, our expectations, it's painful. And it's often our first exposure to letting go of something, and it's often involuntary. But I think what can happen in our minds, is that the painfulness of those involuntary renunciations that so often frequent our lives before we begin to inquire, renunciation then gets associated with pain, with loss, with disconnection, you know, something to be afraid of, something taken away from us. But it's not synonymous. Pain is not synonymous with renunciation. In this path, renunciation is an understanding, and it's also a practice. So, where do we practice renunciation? I guess the answer is obvious. In every moment of clinging. In every moment of clinging. I used to operate under the delusion that it was my responsibility to let go. Has anybody in this path ever found themselves shouting at themselves to let go of something? Have you ever heard yourself being told, you know, it's time to let go? Oh, you really need to let go. It doesn't work that well, does it? That's what I found in my experience, that I could shout at myself probably for years and it wouldn't make a scrap of difference. It is actually, in my understanding, it's a delusion that I let go of anything. I'm pretty sure that I have never let go of a single thing in my entire life. It's interesting, that, isn't it? But it's part of that same delusion that I cling to something. Assuming the responsibility that I need to let go is also part of the assumption of centralizing the power and the authority of a centralized I. Clinging and holding are born of conditions. Clinging and holding, it's not that I cling. In fact, clinging and selfing are words that could almost be used interchangeably. Clinging is an experience, an event that is born of the conditions of wrong view, of fear, of delusion, of insufficiency. Letting go is also born of conditions that are cultivated. Clinging is born of conditions that are often unconsciously cultivated. Letting go is born of conditions that are consciously cultivated. Compassion, calmness, serenity, investigation, insight into the causes and the end of suffering, mindfulness. Does that make sense to you?
Say it again. Yeah.
Which bit?
Can you say it again?
Which bit?
The whole last bit.
That last section.
Maybe more about the letting go.
Think about clinging. When do you ever really consciously cling to anything? Have you ever really looked who is clinging? Or is clinging and selfing two events that are pretty much interwoven and arise simultaneously? Where there is clinging, the selfing of the moment is born. It is not that I go through my life saying I want to cling to this and I'm going to decide to cling to that and I'm going to decide to cling to that. You can see how much clinging arises out of wrong view, out of delusion, out of mindfulness, out of habit, out of impulse, just that taking hold of. It's not something that is consciously cultivated. So if we think of clinging as an event that is born of conditions that are not consciously cultivated, born of the conditions that cause suffering, then think about letting go. I don't let go, because that assumes a centrality of self with a certain power and authority, which simply does not happen because there is no actual centrality of self, of a me who has the power to let go. If I had that power, quite frankly, I don't think I am doing a very good job. Because then I would not be experiencing all the suffering that comes with clinging. In fact, I would just choose to let go. We can see what happens, that letting go is what happens when you... the opening of the hand, when there is the cultivation of the conditions that allow letting go or renunciation to take place. So what are the conditions that allow for letting go to happen? And these are conditions that are consciously cultivated. They're not accidents. Mindfulness, calmness, investigation, inquiry, kindness, understanding suffering and the causes of suffering. These are all of the conditions in which that impulse of clinging, when those conditions are present, that impulse of clinging cannot find a foothold. So instead of shouting at ourselves to let go, it would be, I think, a far wiser use of our effort and energy to cultivate the conditions that allow letting go to happen. I mean, I think this is really a critical point, because I think part of that belief and that centrality of an independent self-existing self is the belief that then I have this power, I make the mistakes, you know, I'm the one who blows it, I'm the one who fails, I'm the one who apparently succeeds. But that is all under review, quite frankly. So think about that different approach. Let me cultivate the conditions in which letting go happens. Now, translate that down into your own experience. How often the times when there are the greatest amounts, greatest degrees of clinging, are in the times in our lives, in our hearts and minds, when there is the greatest degree of fear, of craving, of greed, of unhappiness. Think of the times when you were more at ease in your own mind, your own life, your own heart, when there's less of that sense of contractedness and holding, most likely to be the times when there is a greater degree of inner contentment, ease, calmness, mindfulness, investigation, we're not so prone to grasping. It's so important to translate that down into an experience and to look if that is true for you. So all that we are doing in this path is really consciously cultivating those conditions in which clinging does not find a foothold. There are said to be these two pillars central to the path of liberation, that one is renunciation and the other is compassion. And both of these pillars are essentially a response to suffering and a dedication to bringing suffering to an end. Now, I think it's not hard for us to see in our own experience that to cling to anything at all, when there is clinging to anything at all, there is almost an immediate beginning to suffering. There's almost an immediate beginning to fear, to contractedness, to protectiveness, to defense, and to aggression. It's like suffering is a parent of these two children, renunciation and compassion, if suffering is understood. It's like it's a parent to those two children of renunciation and compassion, if suffering is understood. But from the standpoint of delusion, suffering is the parent of two different children, aversion and resistance. That's the suffering that is not understood, becomes the parent of aversion and resistance. There is a saying from one of the Zen teachers. He was asked by one of his students, "What is the secret of your happiness?" And he answers, "It's the complete, unrestricted cooperation with the unavoidable." The unavoidable, I think, means life. You know, the complete, unrestricted cooperation with the unavoidable. So what is unavoidable in our lives? And, you know, this is a universal story. It's not different from the person who sits beside you or the person who sits in front of you or behind you. It's not different for me. What is unavoidable? Change, instability, uncertainty, no guarantees, nothing that you can actually lean on. What is renunciation? It is the simple willingness to align our hearts and lives with these truths. It's not a big dramatic gesture. It is a simple willingness to align our hearts and minds with these truths of what is unavoidable. What is wrong view? To try and make things stand still through clinging. Wrong view is simply a denial of those truths that are universal. And that's when we're in the state of argument and contention. Anybody have any questions about this? Yes, please.
So you said that suffering is the parent of compassion and renunciation?
If it's understood.
If it's understood. And wouldn't renunciation in that context be more like equanimity?
No, I think it's more of an insight, actually. I would think of it more in the insight in terms of really understanding that which is unavoidable in terms of instability, that things don't stand still, that there is change, that conditions are unreliable, not something to be born of. I think renunciation in this sense is more really that inner alignment with this is actually the way things are. We'll get to equanimity later. It's a little bit, equanimity is a little bit more than that, actually.
Okay.
Okay.
One of the popular sayings that is in our culture right now is, it is what it is. And that's what I hear. It always rubs me wrong when I hear someone say that. But part of that phrase I hear in what you just said.
Well, I mean, it's very easy to turn that phrase into a kind of reprimand, isn't it? Or a kind of cliche.
Or just face it, deal with it, you know, in a kind of succumbing, kind of like you used swallow last time, or early this morning. You have to swallow stuff. And that's what.
Yeah, I certainly don't think renunciation is meant in that way. I mean, it is what it is, and one level, that's perfectly true. You know, things are the way they are. But I think in the sense of this teaching, that's too blanket. It actually needs to be unpacked. That, yes, conditions are unstable. Yes, I don't always get what I want. Yes, I cannot rely on this for happiness. Yes, this does change. That is actually the way it is. But I wouldn't want to turn that... I mean, that is a very profound understanding. That's not a cliche. I mean, that is a very profound understanding. But insight is never meant to be disabling. You know, because, you know, clearly what the Buddha talks about in the teaching, yes... Understanding the way things actually are is the ground for wise action, for wise response, for compassion, for kindness. I mean, you know, the shadow side is passivity. You know, oh, this is the way it is. You know, the shadow side is just kind of roll over, kind of passivity. And what is not being, I think, for me, what's not being acknowledged in that is the whole aspirational side of this path. You know, the whole side of this path, which is rooted in knowing the way things actually are, but within the way things actually are, we aspire to develop a heart and mind that is truly liberated and unshaken and pervaded with compassion and kindness, that is committed to bringing about the end of suffering. There's nothing passive about that. And I think sometimes in that kind of cliched way, what is being negated is that aspirational side. Absolutely. I mean, that would not be a proper understanding of renunciation, you know, because again, you know, we're not talking, you know, in life there is much that is delightful and lovely, much that is difficult and seemingly impossible. What we are really talking about clearly is the core of our understanding and the understanding that is shaping our relationship with all things. So, you know, renunciation doesn't mean, you know, as Suzuki Roshi once said, you know, renunciation is not getting rid of the things of the world, it's accepting that they pass away.
But how do we...
How do you experiment? Well, you know, it's good to have a few little edges here where we do experiment, you know, because it's easy to also fool ourselves into thinking, well, you know, I just really enjoy this. I'm not really identified with it until the museum burns down. You know, and we're bereft and distraught and think, no, that shouldn't be happening. It is happening. So rather than waiting for life to ambush us, I think as a practice, there is a value in exploring these areas where, you know, there may be a mixture of both a deep appreciation and a certain amount of clinging. Now, that's actually our path, that things are often not so clear-cut, you know, that there is often a mixture of sentiments. And sometimes we don't know of the amount of clinging there is until we are no longer able to, until we're somehow deprived of the capacity for the appreciation. So it's good to experiment a little bit, I find, you know, like I often take a renunciation a year, for a whole year. But they're usually things that are quite good for me to sort of release it. You know, like I spent a year, you know, decided I was going to renounce hurrying for a year. It was fantastic. But I could have decided around something, you know. I actually wouldn't so much decide around something that is lovely that is not particularly sort of compulsive. If you get up in the morning and you feel, if I don't go to that art gallery, I'm going to die, I would say it's a good area to experiment in. You know. Otherwise, I do think as a practice, renunciation is something to actually take on.
Just kind of sit with it.
And even make a commitment around restraint, around something that feels kind of, you know, harmless and yet may just be a habit. Okay. There's different dimensions of renunciation. There's sublists to all the lists. There's a few, I think, areas that are really important as practices to look at. I think one is the renunciation of agitation. That's actually quite a good practice. The renunciation of agitation. And I'm not just talking about sort of life agitation, you know, busyness, but the inner agitation where we find ourselves endlessly endeavoring to fix, to control, and to manipulate conditions. I think that's a really useful practice. You know, just to see what it's like to renounce agitation. First, of course, you have to know, spot agitation. And know what agitation. But I think we're all pretty familiar with agitation. You know? That sense of, you know, compulsiveness, I've got to fix this, I've got to control this, I've got to manipulate these conditions. I think another dimension is the renunciation of craving and aversion. This is starting to get to the heart of the matter. But what does it mean not to engage in, not to renounce craving and aversion? It means, I think, understanding that craving and aversion need fuel for their continuity. They have no independent self-existence. You know, so craving needs the fuel of the enchantment, the thoughts, the projections, the pursuits. Aversion needs a lot of fuel. It's like a fire that needs to be fed. Often with thought, often with obsession, often with stories. Renouncing craving and aversion. Aware of how much energy and time on a daily basis can be invested in pursuing craving and aversion. Often a good chunk. To have that commitment to work with that as a practice It means looking at how we fuel craving aversion, looking at how we perpetuate it, looking at what keeps it alive for ourselves. Only we can actually know that. The third dimension of renunciation, I would say, is the renunciation of self-view. All the clinging to the opinions and positions that are born of self-view, the agitation of improving, becoming, asserting, I am, this is me, the moment-to-moment creating of self-view through clinging to body, emotions, objects, experiences, and events. I would say if we really want to practice renunciation, these are the kind of layers to begin to practice with. It's not about renouncing the art gallery. It's not about renouncing, you know, the thing. It's about renouncing first agitation, because agitation stops us seeing clinging, because we're so busy being agitated. The second is the renunciation of craving and aversion, really looking at how that is fed and perpetuated, recognizing it has no independent self-existence. That's so important. Renunciation of self-view. Every time we see the narratives go through, you know, I am, you know, every time we see ourselves kind of constructing a self-view through clinging to opinions, clinging to views, clinging to judgments, to really look, what would it mean in this moment not to feed that? Not to feed that. So again, renunciation is partially something that we do. Also bearing in mind that, you know, remembering how much Pali is a language of verbs. So we don't speak about renunciation as a state or as an achievement or as an attainment. We speak about it as a verb, renouncing. Renouncing. Where? In the moments of clinging. So how do we know clinging? How do we know clinging? How do we know grasping? How do we know identification? Suggestions?
Wherever there is suffering.
Suffering, yeah.
In the body.
In the body, the tightness, the contractedness.
If someone threatens to take it away from us.
Yeah, or we feel threatened.
Fear,
fear.
The spinning
that starts happening. There's a lot of ways we know clinging. I mean, it is a very felt experience. If there's enough mindfulness there to know that felt, I mean, that needs to be there. I mean, in truth, without mindfulness, clinging can be such a sort of, you know, more familiar landscape that we actually think of it as being a normal state of affairs, you know, to go through life. But there are effects. We get tunnel vision, don't we, when there's clinging? You notice how you lose the sense of space, of perspective, you know, of proportion. There gets this tunnel vision. I need this, you know, or I need to get rid of this, or I need to fix this, that kind of tunnel vision. There's often, do you notice there's a forgetfulness? In clinging, there's a kind of amnesiac quality. We forget, actually, you know, in the midst of, say, clinging to aversion, we quite forget, don't we, that the ways in which we may more deeply value kindness and connectedness and dignity and respect is new, you know. There's a forgetfulness of intention, because there's nothing intentional, really, much about clinging. Even when it feels intentional, it's not. There's nothing intentional about clinging. It's a habit. We notice it, as you said, through the proliferation of thinking. That's a good clue. It's a good clue. The clues are there in the body. The clues are there in the mind. We notice it in intensity. Clinging brings intensity. You know, there's a certain intensity about what we are, about that sense of holding on to something. And we notice the I am. The I am. What are the conditions of renunciation? Spaciousness, remembering, the intentions of kindness in body, speech, and mind, the restraint in thinking, investigation again. Is this suffering? What is the outcome of this clinging? It's a good one. What is the outcome of this clinging? Where is it going to end up? What is it going to lead to? Has anybody ever seen clinging leading to happiness? Okay, so, renunciation. I think there's many. I think it's actually the whole of the path that we cultivate. But, you know, the spaciousness, remembering, the intentions of kindness in body, speech, and mind, restraint in thinking. Remember, we talked about restraint being the forerunner of renunciation. And investigation. Is this suffering, and what is its outcome? What is its outcome? I think there is something quite extraordinary about acknowledging inwardly that this is a renunciate path. I mean, many people just wouldn't think about it in that way because it does have that association of a, you know, austerity and bleakness. But actually it's a kind of commitment to freedom. Not kind of, it is a commitment to freedom. Does anybody need to stretch? I'm looking at the time. I'm open to suggestions.
Can we open some windows?
That would be a good thing, wouldn't it? Yes, we can do that. We are going to take a half an hour this afternoon. We have until 4:30, 20 after 4. So it's a question of when we take that half hour. I mean, is anybody feeling a bit dull, heavy? Okay. This might be a good time to, unless there's any questions, because we're going to move on to something else after our break.
I kind of have one thing that I just want to kind of a situation that I just want to share and then have some feedback. So I'm noticing that when these little residual kind of clinging things come up, sometimes it's kind of subtle, and I've noticed it recently in like meetings that I'll have at work with staff who I enjoy and really like working with. But I'm noticing that at times, you know, and usually it's kind of around roles or responsibilities where we'll be having a discussion and I'll begin to feel that edgy quality. And I'm not exactly quite sure what's going on. I have a sense that there's some fear around being a little bit threatened with responsibilities or who should be doing what. And then I notice that I'm becoming very aware of what I think everybody else might be feeling too. And then there's that added agitation, you know, trying to make it all work out well.
Yeah.
So all I can do, so what I've been doing is just like noticing that, noticing my urge to try to make sure everybody is happy. Everybody is, or maybe everybody is safe.
Yeah,
is a better word. And I've noticed that there's also like this slight embarrassment that I'm feeling, and almost like this hypersensitivity that perhaps is somewhat like maybe things just kind of feel. There's that hypersensitivity when I feel like I'm beginning to get a sense of something, that something's going on. And I can intellectually trace that, oh, well, there's some selfing here going on. But I've noticed there's selfing going on. I'm projecting, you know, and I'm selfing for others, too.
Yes. Would you take on that job, don't we? I feel like this, and it must mean you're feeling like this, too, or you're feeling this. I mean, there is a kind of momentum of anxiety within that selfing. You know, that's what I hear. Sort of the agitation has that edginess. There's a certain kind of anxious feeling within the selfing. It's really wonderful that you notice it. You know, it's really wonderful that the mindfulness is there, that you begin to pick up on those messages from the body and from the mind, that there is this kind of process starting to go on of selfing and clinging. I mean, that's a huge step. How we then deal with that may be multidimensional. You know, it may be simply, you know, being able to pause rather than the agitation taking over and things moving faster or filling in the gaps. It may be able to check in with the body. Sometimes in situations, you know, I find it, when it's appropriate, to actually be able to name what's happening. You know, is anyone uncomfortable? You know, I'm sensing it, you know, rather than trying to just kind of pretend something's not happening. You know, it's not always appropriate to do that, but sometimes in situations it is appropriate to be able just simply to name what's going on. Or, and if it's not appropriate to name it outwardly, it's always appropriate to name it inwardly. You know, the difficulty with agitation, particularly when there's a sort of anxiety in the edge to the agitation, is that we try and fill in all the gaps and make everybody happy. You know, we talk more, we, you know, explain more, we're, you know, soothing more, we're reassuring more, rather than, you know, actually feel something going on here. Rather than slowing things down, we speed things up when there's agitation. And sometimes we need to be able to tolerate the discomfort of agitation, you know, just to be able to stay with it and to know this is agitation. This is agitation, rather than being pushed by it.
Feeling like there's something wrong that I have to now do something about.
Yeah.
Just the fact of acknowledging that in this moment I have no idea what else to do.
Right. But there's many things I can do. I can pause, I can listen inwardly, I can name what's going on, if appropriate, outwardly, but always inwardly. I might be able to bring some kindness to that. So there's never a time when there's nothing we can do, because we always have at at hand our capacity for kindness, for knowing, for the intention to be present with. Okay, so this might be a good moment to lift the clouds a little, if clouds do exist. Then we'll come back at, get some fresh air, a little walking. We'll come back at 3:10, and we're going to dive right into Panya, or insight. Just before we move on, I just wanted to bring something into the group that someone raised with me just after the break. And I think it is a very important reminder of just how, you know, understanding the paramis, or actually cultivating the paramis, really only happens when we bring them out of the abstract into the level of, you know, genuine practice and application in our lives. And it's kind of like understanding the macrocosm, you know, knowing the theory, and then looking at how we might actually apply that in our lives. And I think this parami of renunciation is particularly significant in this. Because we often don't know where there's clinging until our clinging is challenged, don't we? And often the ways in which we know our clinging being challenged is from external sources. For example, we often don't know we cling to a view until we meet a contrasting view, and then we really see our clinging to our view. But so there is something about not waiting for external circumstances to challenge that, those areas of clinging, because this is where renunciation is really applied and really liberating. Instead, it's more an inwardly generated investigation. And as this person mentioned to me, it doesn't really matter what it is applied to. It could be anything. You know, I have a cup, you know, we might say, I have a cup of coffee at 10 o'clock. Well, that's very benign, isn't it? It seems. Until the coffee runs out or the schedule goes over and I don't have my cup of coffee at 10 o'clock. But it's not that it's the coffee, it could be anything. You know, it could be I need to sleep on the side of the bed, I need to have that seat in the airplane, I need to, you know, have my life regimen. It could be anything at all that we actually kind of select out, and let's see what happens when this is not happening in this way. You know, and that's what I mean about taking renunciation on as a practice. It's not about the thing. It's not that there's anything terrible about having a cup of coffee at 10 o'clock. But what we understand is that clinging has no conscience. So it would seize on the cup of coffee as much as it would seize on a particular view or a particular aversion or a particular craving or a particular self-view. So in many ways it's actually taking the little things and actually let's see what it's like just not to engage in this particular habit or this particular impulse, you know, for this week or this month or whatever. Let's just see what happens, just opening up that field, because when we open up that field it really draws us really into what I was talking about, these levels of renunciation around looking at the power or the role that craving aversion might play in our lives, you know, looking at the role that self-view might play in our lives. Because I say so much of this just goes on underneath the radar. You know, it's not necessarily consciously registered until externally it were somehow shortchanged. So it's almost seen that clinging is as much a habit as any other habit in our lives. It becomes almost a reflex action, you know, to take hold of this, to take hold of that. And it's beginning to undo the habit pattern of that clinging, which I think actually it may sound depressing, but actually this is actually practicing with an edge. You know, and it is, certainly in my experiences, I've always found it very important to have an edge in my practice. You know, a sort of ongoing sense of exploration where I'm kind of playing with that edge, you know, looking into what I don't know rather than what I know. And I think that edge is so, it's actually what brings a sense of aliveness to our practice. You know, it's almost the way in which our practice becomes a path, the path of our lives, where we're just looking at the edges and exploring what it means actually not to be, you know, governed by impulse, by habit, by clinging. And that only happens actually when we bring this out of the kind of theory level into the context of our day-to-day lives and the manner of our lives. You know, I have to drive this way. Do I? You know, I always get agitated in traffic jams. Do I? You know, this is the way I am. That's a big one. This is just the way I am. That usually means, please don't ask me to change. Or it sometimes means, please would you change so that I don't have to change. You know, because this is just the way that I am. To begin to actually challenge some of these assumptions, I think, what it is, the assumptions. Yeah.
Could you speak of, it seems like of all of these, renunciation is the one that is, in particular with Buddhism, is like, that's the bummer of Buddhism.
That's the bummer of Buddhism. Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, that's the part of Buddhism, that and suffering and all that. but what do you think are some of the common misunderstandings about renunciation? What do you think are the common things that we don't really understand when we hear the word? We immediately go into a knee-jerk reaction about renunciation. It's not really the truth about renunciation.
I think one of the, you know, there's a lot of mythology that surrounds renunciation, and I think it is just as you say, that it's a bummer, you know, rather than a joy, that it's deprivation rather than freedom, you know, that it means disconnection or unrelatedness rather than actually really probably the deepest level of connection with the way things are. And then there's so much mythology about it. Perhaps it's because in our culture, you know, those are the associations that we've grown up with, if we ever hear the word renunciation. I can't even imagine how old I was when I first heard the word renunciation, but it was quite on in there. You know, and I think also part of the mythology perhaps comes when we see, just from the outside, the monastic tradition. You know, and certainly, you know, I shouldn't say this. But, you know, certainly, you know, there are parts of the monastic tradition, I would say, that seem to specialize in grimness. And then we do see that. And I'm not mocking that or making fun of it, because, you know, and I think it's only what we see from the outside. You know, we don't see from the inside. But I think there's often that appearance of a certain austerity, you know, a sort of life disconnection that gets associated with the monastic tradition, which is really probably our clearest representation of the renunciate tradition, is in the monastic tradition. Of course, what we don't see, what we're seeing then reflected, is our mythology, rather than what actually may be happening there. You know, because, I mean, you go somewhere like Sri Lanka, you know, and you go in a monastery. It's the only place I've ever seen people, you know, doing walking meditation, you know, with a great smile on their face, you know, actually really enjoying this. You know, this tremendous sense of life and warmth and kindness and joy. And we don't always see that part. But I think that that association of renunciation and monasticism is very, very close, for, I think, for many people. And also, you know, there's a part of us that, you know, really just does not like the idea. I think that's a big piece. It's not just mythology. There's a part of us when we can be so embedded in the idea of self, of I, that always is in reliance upon things, upon clinging. And I think there's a part of us that probably feels quite threatened by the idea of, by the very concept of renunciation, never mind the reality, because we just see it as this somehow, you know, that our worlds are going to be unpicked and unraveled. And they probably will be, but not in the way that we think. You know, we think that unraveling is going to be a kind of prescription for misery, rather than as a prescription for joy.